back and happy winter solstice. It's the popular show with me, James A. Smith, and I'm thrilled that we can give listeners a Christmas present right at the end of the recording year of an interview with one of the really significant intellectuals in Europe today, Kostas Lapavitsas. Welcome to the popular show.
Very pleased to be with you, and thank you for the introduction.
It's really great to have you here. Let me just shout out to listeners, if you want to support us and keep independent radical media and interviews like this one happening, get over to patreon.com/thepopularpod, where subscribers only can receive the interview I did earlier today with Piers Robinson about the events of October 7th. It's great to be with Kostas. Let me start by reminding the listeners about some of your political career before we get into your current intellectual work. Back in 2015, when you were elected to Greek Parliament as part of the Syriza wave, the left populist uprising, Jacobin magazine referred to you as the anti-Varoufakis, not only in style and personal trajectory, but more importantly in terms of political line. You were the figure most identified with maintaining Syriza's oppositional relationship to the European Union. You were the figure who was perhaps most vocal in demanding that Greece refuse to continue to be enslaved to the Eurozone and to this situation as a sort of debtor country. You weren't listened to at the time with pretty disastrous results. But this year, the Greek election, was it back in May, saw you back on stage with Yanis Varoufakis. Maybe you could get us up to speed about the current sort of state of the Greek left. What led to that kind of reuniting with that sort of old guard of the Syriza radical left? What the situation for the Greek left looks like right now?
A lot of questions, which would take a lot of time, but I'll be very brief. Yanis Varoufakis had a very important and responsible position back in 2015. And the truth is, he didn't manage it very well. And he didn't manage it very well because the basic understanding was the EU could be reformed and the EMU could be reformed. He believed in that. And he thought they could be reformed if a good argument was found and strong political support could be somehow mobilized to force reforms that would be in the interest of working people or the interests of broad layers of people, not big business. That was our argument and our difference. My view was that this was impossible.
Yes.
For institutional and political reasons. And basically, I lost the argument, not to Varoufakis, but to Syriza. The interesting thing is that Varoufakis also lost his argument, and he lost it in some ways more decisive ways than me, because he continued to think that this institutional creation in Europe could be reformed. He formed this thing called Diem across Europe with like-minded people. They set up 2025 as a deadline for reforming Europe and so on. And they went down that path. Now, I argued again after the collapse of Syriza and in relation to the Diem that this was a wild goose chase. Varoufakis has come to the same conclusion. So it's not a case of meeting halfway or anything like that. It's just that Yanis has come to realize that he was not really on, that he was a wild goose chase and the assumptions were wrong. Now, you've got to give him credit for that. There aren't very many political figures that mess up, and he did mess up as Minister of Finance, that there aren't very many figures that mess up and have the honesty to come out and say, look, I made a mistake.
Yes.
And to do that while also moving to the left. See, our world is moving to the right. Look at Europe. It's moving to the right at the rate of knots. People are politicians and others moving on to positions which would have been thought unthinkable 10 years ago. Yanis Varoufakis, for all his faults, and I will be the first one to point them out, has moved to the left. Look at his positions on Palestine. Look at what he's been saying about the European Union. And so the argument was that we should have a public meeting in Athens prior to the elections of this summer and basically strike out some common ground between us and for the benefit of the radical left. We did. It was a tremendous success as an event. But as you know, the result of the election was not good for the radical left. That has to do with some of the personal choices made by the political bodies that we formed in order to contest the election. Mostly to do with that, really. But more broadly, it has to do with the disillusionment of the Greek people, as the left is concerned. The left has basically shot its bolt in Greece. I mean, up until 2015, when Syriza was elected, to cut the long story short, whatever the left, by which I mean the radical left, Syriza and so on, which was the dominant party then, whatever the left asked the Greek people to do for it, the Greek people did. Give us a majority. Here it is. Vote no in the key referendum of the summer 2015. Here it is. The Greek people might have 1,001 weaknesses. I'll be the first one to acknowledge them, right? But when it came to that, whatever the Greek left asked them, the people to do, the people did. It's the left that basically messed it up. Didn't deliver. It promised enormous things and didn't deliver anything. Anything. It surrendered essentially without a fight. It thought that it fought, but it didn't. It wasn't really a fight. It was just a lot of waffle in Brussels and elsewhere. They basically capitulated.
It's agony to remember it. And you are also unusual in having been right and ignored, not just in one national radical left, but in two, following that 2015 Syriza adventure from your professorial chair at the University of London. You supported Corbyn and you supported Brexit and wrote an outstanding defense of outstanding critique of the EU, published as a kind of critique of the anti-Brexit strand in Corbynism. And of course, the UK left didn't listen to those arguments either, with disastrous results. We're staring down the barrel of a general election here in the UK next year. And just as the Greek radical left is in this state of having shot the bolt and being a kind of outsider force now, having previously had this amazing kind of window of opportunity, there's a slightly lower stakes, perhaps. There's a similar dynamic in the UK radical left. We're not going to have a place in the election next year. Corbyn himself is probably not even going to be running as a Labour MP. As somebody who sort of sees these things both from the inside and the outside, what do you think the UK left should be doing strategically when it's a choice between Sunak and Starmer next year?
Oh, dear. It's interesting. In some ways, the failure of the British left is worse than the Greek left, in some ways. You see, the British left had an opportunity given to it on a plate, which didn't win itself. Syriza at least won the opportunity by being a party that took part in all actions and activities and so on. The British left was given it because of the peculiarities of voting within the Labour Party. But he was given it. What was remarkable about the British left during those early years is that the program they came up with for economy and broadly society was the most radical program we've seen in Europe in 40 years. Far more radical than Syriza. Syriza was full of waffle, basically. I mean, the program they came up with in 2015, I publicly criticized just before the election. I said, this is nonsense. And it was. The program of the Labour Party in 2017 and so on was a very serious piece of work. And if it began to be implemented, it would have been a dramatic change in this country and in Europe. It would have been the first serious attempt to go against this catastrophe that has befallen us for decades in Europe and elsewhere. You see, so the stakes were very high. It failed disastrously. Why? Because obviously the British elite had the knives out and they used everything that they could to undermine Corbyn and the people around him. But it didn't fail just because of that. What did you expect the British elite to do? I mean, pat you on the back and say, get on with it, my boy? No, I mean, they wouldn't. The real problem was, of course, the weaknesses within the Corbyn camp, and they can be summed up in a single word, Brexit. You know, the inability to understand how to position yourself in relation to Brexit. And the tragedy was that several people within that group understood full well the weaknesses of the EU. It's not, you know, it's not like Syriza, where a lot of people in the leadership were utterly befuddled about the EU, including Yanis Varoufakis, who really believed that, you know, this thing can be changed. A lot of people in the leadership of the Labour Party under Corbyn had no illusions in the EU. And yet, they did nothing about Brexit. They failed to understand that you can't say that I'm not going to talk about Brexit. You know, let's talk about love. You can't talk about love. You can't talk about Brexit. So that came and, you know, destroyed them, came back and destroyed them, essentially. It was a matter of democracy. It was a matter of what people wanted, and they were destroyed by it. The real tragedy for the country, however, came afterwards. Corbyn failed, as he shouldn't have done. He should have taken charge of the Brexit issue. The real tragedy came afterwards with Boris Johnson, who proved completely, completely not up to the task. He didn't understand it. I mean, he and his crew basically thought that Brexit was an opportunity to remake Britain in the mold of the 19th century, the buccaneering middle class and whatever else, all the contracts they were going to sign in the Pacific, and utter nonsense, got nothing to do with the present day reality. The only way that Brexit would have worked, was by taking the real opportunities they gave to remake the productive foundations of this country, to give its working people, its people generally, an opportunity to get involved in the economy, to produce, to alter the structure of the economy. Could have been done. It can still be done, but not by this Tory government. I mean, these people, I mean, the proverbial brewery and so on, I mean, it's obvious. And that has been a disaster for Britain, for the country. And we see it all around us in terms of what the economy and society are doing. So now we've got the choice of Sunak, who is unelected, the second unelected prime minister. He's clearly not up to the task. He's a mediocrity. It's perfectly obvious. He might not be as much of a mediocrity as Liz Truss was, but he is a mediocrity. And Keir Starmer. And what can I say about Keir Starmer? I mean, it's a contest between two mediocrities, essentially. And the only reason why he's doing well in the polls is because people have had it up to here with the Tory incompetence. So what should the left do? First of all, what is the left now? The defeat of Trotskyism, the defeat of Corbynism. I mean, it's a slip of the tongue, which is not accidental, mm-hmm. But the defeat of Corbynism has been very bad for the left. It's a historic defeat. We need to reorganize and marshal our strengths again. We need new ideas. We need new proposals. We cannot side. Obviously, we cannot go with the Tory party, but we cannot side with Starmer's Labour Party. That's a disastrous organization now. We need new ideas, new proposals. We need to approach working people again. We need to become part of the breathing and living working people of this country. We need to listen to what they're saying and formulate ideas and proposals for the here and now. It's a difficult task. It will take a long time. Things are not moving in our direction. I'm sorry to sound glum.
Well, there are times when that is the principled and essential thing to do. There are plenty of cases of left in defeat, carrying on careering forward and running in the exact wrong direction. But one text that can start to edge us towards the right direction is The State of Capitalism, Economy, Society, and Hegemony, which is your new book from Verso Books, written with collaborators. This is a really, really welcome guide to the economic history of the post-financial crash and COVID, crucially, the COVID period. And it is the most comprehensive Marxist analysis that I've seen of the economy during the world economy during that period. Before we get into some of the specificity of the argument, I just want to pick up on a couple of formulations that you've already made in those introductory remarks. Put it this way, whenever there is a big rise in accusations of anti-Semitism, especially around Israel, such as we're witnessing at the moment, one of the arguments that is always wheeled out is that the left today is too preoccupied with ideas of productive and unproductive capitalism and is too anxious about finance, when actually these are all capitalist structures and you should treat them all equally, because otherwise you're going to end up being an anti-Semite who hates unproductive parasites and hates international financiers. I mean, I'm saying this in a parodic way, but the argument is made, I'm afraid to say. This is a critique of finance and a critique of unproductive economic activity, first of all. So can you just defend why a Marxist should be specific about the kind of capitalism that is the priority to discredit at this point?
Let me say, first of all, that if only the left in Europe, Britain, Europe, and elsewhere was concerned strongly with characterizing the economic nature of contemporary capitalism. If only. I mean, there was a time when the left was accused of something called economic determinism. I mean, young generations probably don't know what this means. But
chance would be a fine thing.
chance would be a fine thing. I mean, the left today is concerned about, you know, moral issues, gender issues, I don't know, other kinds of rights and so on. They are the issues that really get it hot under the collar. And it's right to do so. But that's what it is. Economy and characterizing capitalism, that's not what the left is concerned with primarily today. Actually, there's very little. It's the opposite of economic determinism, right? Actually, the left has become economic non-determinist. And that's not accidental. It has to do with the retreat and the weaknesses of the left since the collapse of the Soviet Union, but also since the retreat of the left in Europe and elsewhere from the 80s. So in our book, we thought that our first task would be to give a picture of what core capitalism looks like, and what peripheral capitalism looks like, and what the system as a whole looks like in economic terms, first and foremost, but not only, of course, not only. Now, why do we want to do that? Why do we want to characterize contemporary capitalism? Because that's the main task of Marxists. I mean, otherwise, it's just an abstract exercise that I can do in my study. I don't need to be concerned about the world. I can have a model of what capitalism would look like or is like and start discussing capitalists, workers, financiers, their abstract relations, have models and which have nothing to do with the world. I mean, active interventionist, real political Marxism is about what capitalism looks in the here and now. And it is to do with periodizing capitalism. Capitalism in the 1830s was very different from capitalism in the 1860s, which was very different from the capitalism in the 1890s and 1900s, and so on, right? And the first task of Marxists and all radicals really today is to say, what does capitalism look like now, and therefore what does one need to do, in order to overthrow it, because that's the objective. So that's what we decided where to do. And obviously, finance is crucial here. Finance is crucial here because use your eyes. Your naked eyeball will tell you that finance is very important, but it isn't just finance. Now, if people want to associate that with anti-Semitism or Jewish capitalism, that's their privilege and their stupidity, to be honest, because it's got nothing to do with that. Absolutely nothing to do with that. We were concerned with characterizing what we see. What does capitalism look like in Europe? What does it look like in the United States in the core, right? What we call the old established capitalism. Why is it malfunctioning so badly? In what ways? And what does it look like in the periphery? What does it look like in this huge expanse of what we call the global South? And often people have got no idea what's happening in the global South. What does it look like in China? What does it mean to see all these massive new powers emerging, which are capitalistic? They're not non-capitalist. And they're contesting the world market. What position should socialists take? How to position yourself in that? What does socialism mean today? That's what was our concern. And there, as you say, we focused on finance, but we also focused on production. And we saw the connection between the two. And I'm happy to discuss it further if you want to go down that path.
The pandemic hit after a decade lost to austerity, a decade of states trying to recoup what they'd lost in the financial crash, trying to put out the fires of new kinds of protest and social disorder and resistance that erupted, and also to try to retain the hierarchies that had been in place before through this new kind of unfamiliar water. The pandemic arrives in 2020 when really there had been no solution presented to that long financial crisis and recession. What happened next?
It's a good question. In a sense, it's a question that we dealt with in detail in our book. But as you suggested, we also discussed, in a sense, the entire period. Because for us, it really is 15 years of the same type of process in capitalism. Since the great crisis of 2007-2009, the great explosion or implosion of finance in 2008. It's really the same 15 years going on. We characterize that as an interregnum, using the term of Antonio Gramsci. And I think advisedly, because an interregnum is a time when the old cannot go on any longer, but the new cannot be born. And we think that this is what's happening right now, and for 15 years. As you said, the decade leading to the pandemic was a lost decade. I mean, the data is obvious for the core, right, for the established countries. Austerity on the one hand, in this country, especially Britain, is appalling. I mean, the option that George Osborne made, for which he was lauded, incidentally, in 2012, 2013, apparently he was playing a blinder. He didn't know what he was doing. I mean, austerity was disastrous for Britain, but it wasn't just Britain. It was elsewhere too. So austerity on the one hand, which suppressed aggregate demand, really dampened aggregate demand, and on the other, sustained weakness of the production side, not the demand side, the supply side, the sustained weakness of the production side. The combination was deadly. No growth, essentially. The worst period for growth, and very weak results elsewhere, which again we can discuss. And then after 10 years of this, dealing with the outcomes of this appalling crisis in 2008 in this way, shifting the burden onto working people, pressing wages down and so on, the pandemic arrives. When the pandemic arrived, for us, this group that I basically coordinated to produce the book, co-authors of mine, we were astonished by the nature of state intervention. And I'll tell you why we were astonished. Because we've spent decades talking about neoliberal capitalism, in which presumably the market is so powerful and the state is so weak. Yeah, Yeah, pull the other one. I mean, the state in 2020 in the core countries demonstrated phenomenal power, unprecedented power in the economic field, in the political field, and in the social field. I don't think anything like that has been witnessed in peace times before. They shut down enormous cities, deadened them in a weekend. They spent vast amounts of money, which they discovered behind the sofa. Don't forget, there was 10 years of austerity previously when there wasn't any money. And suddenly there was plenty of money. They supported big business and small business. They sent money through the post to working people. They kept people being paid while not at work, furlough in this country. But primarily they supported big business. For us, this was extraordinary. And we had to discuss it. We had to see, what does this mean? And the basic argument that we've come up with is that contemporary capitalism, during these 15 years of the interregnum, is unthinkable without the state. It scratches basically various parts of the state. It relies on the state. It's impossible to continue to exist without the state. It's unthinkable. Western capitalism without the state today is unthinkable. The pure neoliberals, those who imagine that there's a war against the state and somehow they don't know what they're talking about. And that's the crew around Boris, incidentally, whom I mentioned previously. Contemporary capitalism is unthinkable without the states. There are essentially, there is one fundamental lever that the state uses in this. And that's what makes it interesting. In the West, I mean, in the core. It's not property over resources, because he has privatized what it used to own. It doesn't directly own resources. It doesn't directly intervene in production. It hasn't got its own capacity to produce things, be they public utilities or whatever else it is. They're not public anymore. I mean, essentially, they're privatized. The main lever it has is control over money. Control over money created by the central bank. That is the main lever of power. And obviously tax, right? But tax is something that has to be done reasonably carefully on the part of the state. It's a very old lever. The new lever that matters is control over money. So we've got a combination of tax on the one hand and power over money on the other. And the really new thing is power over money. Contemporary capitalism is, again, unthinkable without the incredible control of money by the central bank. This form of money is new in the history of capitalism. It's fiat, created by the state, because the central bank is an arm of the state. I mean, it pretends to be independent, but independent of what? I mean, it's an arm of the state. It's fiat money, created through the banking system. It's a very peculiar fiat money, backed by state instruments of debt. The central bank buys public debt, basically, and monetizes it, creates money, and used to support aggregate demand as and when the state wishes to do it. The amounts of money they've created in this way, the size of the central bank in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in European Union, in Japan right now, is without precedent in the history of capitalism. These are mammoths, gigantic institutions, right in the middle of the financial system, commanding the flows of loanable money capital, commanding the direction of financialization by creating money. That's fundamental for us. And we saw it very clearly demonstrated in the pandemic. We thought we had to discuss it, analyze its limits, find where it was going, and actually show the difference between core and periphery of contemporary capitalism by pivoting on that. Because in the periphery, it's not the same. Peripheral capitalist countries cannot do the same. And that begins to give you a sense of how core and periphery are related today. It gives you a sense of what imperialist domination means today. It has to be analyzed in that way.
The austerity period can be seen as characterized by states retaining their role as the sort of the side man of financial capital by withdrawing money from the or withdrawing liquidity from the real economy and from people's actual lived existence in order to protect its place in this kind of abstract realm of finance. We get into the COVID period, and all of a sudden that money is being sort of flooded into certain parts of people's lives. Now, a lot of people on the left imagined that in Britain, COVID was going to be Corbynism by other means. Because the pandemic was that serious and that significant, the government was going to learn its lesson, and Boris Johnson was going to become some kind of socialist because he'd be forced to. That in order to deal with the pandemic, you'd need to have this kind of new turn to a kind of quasi-socialist state intervention. And that's why a lot of people on the British left, and indeed the left across the West, sort of saw it as their role to be the commander-in-chief of lockdown propaganda. Like, whatever the COVID measure proposed was, they were its biggest cheerleader, and governments were only to be criticized on the basis that they weren't doing enough. There weren't enough mandates, there weren't enough restrictions, et cetera, et cetera. Now, even something like furlough, I've been arguing for a long time, the furlough that was used to pay part of people's wages during lockdown, that seemed like this incredible socialist measure. Indeed, a lot of people gave John McDonnell credit for it, that he was there, you know, before Corbyn was deposed and Starmer came in. McDonnell was there advising the Tories on how to do the furlough policy. But really, what you have to see, as far as I'm concerned, in the furlough policy, is that it was just a way of maintaining the hierarchy preserved in amber, ready for after lockdown, so that everyone could continue as they were without there having been any real kind of change in people's relations to each other. Lockdown was not a kind of means by which society could be massively transformed by this bizarre shared experience and this new kind of role of the state. Rather, it was a way of putting everything on ice so that as much of capitalism as possible could be picked up in the same state as it was before. I mean, you give a, I don't know how far you'd agree with that, but I really found resonant the argument that you made that so much of the economic decision-making made during COVID was really about rescuing the status quo, as you put it. Finance quickly adapted to new conditions. Enormous volumes of money were created to purchase public securities, thus ensuring that the privileged elite that commands financial assets remained liquid and its wealth was protected. Was lockdown, far from being a sort of transformational experience, was it actually an exercise in keeping things as they were as much as possible in the face of a crisis?
No transformation at all. Those who believe that it was the end of neoliberalism, people argue that, were completely misled. It was, in a sense, as you mentioned, a holding exercise. Well, a bit more than that, but certainly no radical transformation or anything like that. Neoliberalism, you see, is not simply about not spending money or being tight with people's wages or whatever it is, all the miseries and all the stuff that's coming back now, right? It isn't just about that. It's about a lot more than that. Two fundamental things were never touched. Two fundamental things of neoliberalism were never touched during the pandemic. The first was labor rights. The governments of this country and elsewhere intervened extensively, but not in regard to labor rights, unionization, strike action, and so on. And second, property rights, the sacra of capitalism, labor and property. They were beyond intervention by states during that time. In other words, during the pandemic, this government, or rather the UK government, and other governments in Europe and elsewhere, engaged in extraordinary acts of intervention, such as the ones you mentioned, giving the furlough money. But more than that, they gave money to corporations to pay wages. In other words, they nationalized the wage bill. Basically, that's what it was. If you think of capitalism as an economic activity, the wage bill is really what the capitalist must advance. That's the money that the capitalist must advance to hire the workers, right? And that money was actually provided to a large extent by the public sector, by the government in this country and elsewhere. In other words, they nationalized the wage bill. They also nationalized the income statement. In other words, they boosted profits. They didn't get anywhere. They didn't take any drastic action with nationalizing equity, however. Even when they took over equity, they took a step back, because equity is, of course, the holy grail. There's no capitalism without property rights of means of production and so on. So it wasn't really a challenge to neoliberalism. It was actually an indication of the flexibility of neoliberalism, which is a very flexible way of managing things. It's not as rigid as people think. It was a holding exercise. It didn't really change the world. It didn't really bring, all that was just waffle of the time. People were just completely caught up in the extraordinary steps that were being taken to keep the system going, to prevent complete collapse, to forestall utter disaster. Systemic disaster. That's what it was. During that time, the state, moreover, if I may say one more thing, demonstrated not only its ability to intervene in the economy without precedent, but it also showed its ability to intervene in democratic and social life generally. The authoritarianism was without precedent. The ability of the state to shut people up, to tell you what to do, to impose policies, it was just without precedent in peace times, in so-called democratic countries anyway. The state is a colossus right now. If it appears weak, if it doesn't do things, it's because it chooses not to do them. It's not that it can't do it. It chooses not to do it. When it chooses to intervene, it intervenes, and it intervenes without precedent.
The book holds back from making a firm judgment on what should have been done in COVID. But it's clear that the battle lines remain a sort of, you know, pro-anti-lockdown, pro-anti-mandates kind of position. Can I put it to you that a lot of the left came out of the austerity experience, the Brexit experience, the kind of EU experience, telling themselves they'd learned their lesson? Oh, I was wrong to oppose Brexit. Oh, I was wrong to think that Greece could be saved from austerity while remaining in the Eurozone. I've got it now. I'm anti-EU. And then immediately replaced the EU with the WHO, or immediately replaced the EU with the technocracy of COVID. But these guys are good. This stuff I can accept without question. I can support it being taken out of political questioning. I mean, incidentally, I was delighted and surprised to find that I'm now looking at a Verso book that has Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Toby Green in the footnotes. This has got to be a first, the first time that these kinds of critical of COVID measure voices have been allowed in a prominent left publication.
I mean, as far as the footnotes are concerned, we take thinking and speech very seriously, and if there are arguments that are worth mentioning, we do mention them. We've got no constraints when it comes to that, other than obviously quoting fascists positively and open racists and so on. Now, in terms of the left and COVID and us, we were very concerned about the implications of lockdowns and so on for democratic rights and what it shows about the state. Having said this, it was very difficult to see what alternatives were available. It was very difficult to see, let's be honest. When the thing broke out, first of all, it wasn't well understood. I mean, hindsight is 20/20 vision, as you know. I mean, I well remember the time in early 2020 when actually there wasn't that much knowledge about COVID-19 and so on. People didn't really know that much about it. Remember the all that talk about washing your hands, as if you washed your hands half a dozen times a day, then you'd keep COVID away. And then that was forgotten after a while. And so on. So we were very concerned about it. And we didn't want to pretend to be something which we're not. We're not scientists. We don't understand the technicalities of it. But then again, we made a very important point. There is no such thing as science which is beyond and above society. And actually, mentioning science all the time during COVID was an excellent way for big business and for repressive states to do what they wanted to do, which became very clear because everybody was mentioning science in core countries, even though they were following different policies. Like, it can't be that there is one science for Sweden and another science for Britain. It just doesn't happen, right? And it can't be that all of them, both of them use the science to legitimate what they do. So we were very concerned about that. And we try to keep a sensible line without pretending that we are something which we're not. We believe that it was possible to follow a more democratic and pro-worker, pro-ordinary people position on that, but it would have involved spending a lot of money. It would have involved taking a different position with regard to provision of all kinds of medication and facilities and so on at grassroots level. And They were not prepared to do that. Governments were not prepared to do that. So we went down the vaccination path, and the vaccination path was in the interest of big business. It was a decision taken by governments whose medical sector is dominated by big pharma. Big pharma has got big interests in vaccines and so on. And it was a huge risk taken with regard to public health. We don't know the outcomes yet. Because this was a huge experiment. These vaccines were a huge experiment. We will know only in several years ahead. We do know that corners were cut because the risk was so huge, they had to do it quickly. And all that was driven by Big Pharma. And suddenly, Big Pharma, which is poisonous, and that has been well known and destructive of public health, was elevated into the savior of humanity. Pfizer, one of the worst big businesses in the world, suddenly basked in glory as the enterprise that rescued the world. I mean, it's appalling. It's appalling. It really is a historical indictment of contemporary capitalism.
Another of the mythologies of the period was that we were experiencing something akin to the Second World War and that it would have similar economic effects. So I remember reading in the Daily Telegraph that we would come out of lockdown with this huge kind of soaring, roaring economy that was going to meet all this new consumer demand. People had been paying off credit cards and so on. There was going to be this huge boom. I remember reading in the pages of all kinds of millennial left magazines that the workers had, you know, learned to decenter labor from their life, and there was going to be all this trade union militancy, and we were going to have another 1945 as a result. Instead, what do we see around us? We see a couple of years of inflation and raised interest rates. We see a decimated public sphere where people are still afraid to go out or have just forgotten how to. And well, if the war metaphor was useful for anything, it accounts for the acceleration of international conflict that we've seen in the years following COVID. How would you handle those misconceptions and their after effects?
Yeah, I mean, COVID was, as you said rightly, likened to a war. And in some ways it was like a war. And I mean, there were curfews, for God's sake. There were travel restrictions. There were all kinds of impositions on everyday life, which were reminiscent of war conditions. But that was it. That was it. I mean, in terms of how the economy worked and what it meant, it was anything but war. You see, in a war, what happens in a war is that the productive capacity of a country is forcibly directed towards military production. That's what war is, right? You engage in a war, you've got to produce the guns, or you've got to support the army, which is fighting the war. That means that you've got to choose between guns and butter. And you consume less butter because you need the guns. And therefore, your productive capacity for peacetime goods is limited. with everything that this means for people's lives and the way the country works and will work subsequently. There was nothing like that in COVID. It's not that we directed huge amounts of resources to fight COVID. What resources? To fight COVID, where? I mean, the amount of money that medicine absorbed, extra money that medicine or medical provision absorbed, was a very small part of the total expenditure. It's not that we devoted huge amounts of money to fighting COVID. What happened was that a global economy, which was in a very precarious position after 10 years of austerity and sustained production problems, was hit by this hurricane, which was exacerbated by actions of states, key states. Demand collapsed because people were forced to stay at home. Supply was disrupted enormously because global value chains were disrupted and people were kept away from work. And the combination of these two shocks, to demand and to supply, exacerbated the weakened position of the core economies several times. That's basically what happened. But the logic of operation of the core economies didn't change in the slightest. States intervened, they spent money, like I said to you before, they created money, but they also spend money through the fiscal mechanisms this time. It wasn't just creation of money, they went beyond what they had done in the previous period, and they now lifted the fiscal dam and started spending money fiscally. So it was a combination of monetary and fiscal expenditure because they were confronted with this huge shock to a weakened economy. And they knew they had to intervene quickly. That's basically what happened. Did they touch the underlying mechanisms? No. Property was not touched at all. Labor rights were not, they were not loosened in favor of workers. They were very hard about that. The core of neoliberalism was maintained. All these actions were in the interest of big business and big finance. The outcome, well, you see it. We saw it soon after. I mean, when you stretch money creation to enormous extents, right, to an enormous extent, I mean, the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the United States, reached above $9 trillion. That's a lot of dollars, you know. $9 trillion. That's money creation. The balance sheet of the European Central Bank is very close to that. When you create money in that way, and therefore you support aggregate demand, because that's what it means, right? You give money to big business, you give money to people and so on. When you support aggregate demand in this way, and then once the conditions of the lockdown are eased a bit, because you realize that COVID is not killing that many people, lockdown can be weakened now, and therefore people begin to go out again and start spending a little bit more than they did before. When these things happen, but supply is as weakened as it has been for years, the result will be inflation. It was predicted. It was predictable. It was predicted. What's going to happen is an increase in prices because you're boosting demand. The demand is returning, but supply cannot respond. If it cannot respond, then prices will go up. Add to it the wars that then happen, and you get inflation. Now, the key problem, therefore, for us, and I think it's clear in this country, is not the demand side, is not austerity as we were used to saying before. Actually, it's the supply side. The real weakness of the British economy and of the other economies, the core economies, is the supply side. It's actually, in other words, the side of production, to be Marxist about this. The side of production, the side of value creation, the side of profit making. That's the real weakness. And that you can see very, very clearly, and we provided the evidence, in three crucial ways. First of all, productivity growth is appalling. In this country is the worst in the West, probably. Nothing, no productivity growth at all for years. Trade unions get wound up when productivity is mentioned, and rightly so, because it's the bosses always mentioning productivity growth and what you've got to do to increase productivity. However, that aside, capitalism doesn't work if productivity doesn't rise. Capitalism is predicated on increasing the productivity of labor to support profitability. That's how capitalism works. When productivity doesn't grow, capitalism has a problem on the production side. The reason why productivity hasn't grown is because investment has been very weak. Investment is absent. It's very weak investment across the West. So weak investment, weak productivity growth, weak profitability. The only way you can make profits in this situation is by pushing wages down. Continuous pressure on wages. Keep wages down to make profits. But weak profitability. So weak productivity, weak profitability. The result? Zombie firms. There is thousands of them. I read in the Financial Times 2 days ago. My, oh my. Lots of firms are going bankrupt when interest rates as interest rates are going up. Why? They're zombies. We discussed them in our book. They're zombies. In other words, they're very weak productively. They're very weak in profitability terms. They survive because interest rates are low. Credit is cheap. When interest rates go up, they go out of business. That's the reality of the weak supply side. So the real problem is weak productive capitalism in the West. The triumph of finance, big money being made by finance, financialization making big money through banks and so on, weak production. Now, I'm not suggesting for a minute that finance is bad, production is good. Don't misunderstand me. That's not, I'm just reading the situation, diagnosing the situation. So COVID and the response to it was at the macro level, give money, fiscal expenditure, create money. But in, if you like, the micro side, in other words, the way production works and so on, was not up to it. And so you got inflation. So what is inflation? Prices rising, except they don't rise in the same way across the board. And therefore, what you get, as John Maynard Keynes pointed out 100 years ago, what you get through inflation is a vast income transfer. If prices generally rise, but wages rise by less, workers lose income. It's mechanical. Workers lose income, real income. Who obtains it? Businesses, because profits go up, because their prices go up. So profits in 2021 and 2022 went through the roof. Not because there was a wave of investment, a wave of productivity growth, a wave of capitalism, dynamic capitalism going play. No. Because of inflation. It was actually taking money out of workers' pockets and putting them into the balance sheets of big business. That's basically what happened the last couple of years. And that's where we are. In this, I can only describe it as decrepit capitalism.
It's been done with a sort of impunity as well in recent years. I mean, in the pre-COVID austerity period, at least they had the decency to lie. There's no money left. Haven't you seen this note from the last Treasury that says there's no money left? We have to balance the books. Then we can start giving you money. On this side of things, it's not even that kind of internal economic argument anymore. No, we can't. We don't have any money because of COVID measures. Oh, well, are we allowed to debate the COVID measures? No, you're banned from YouTube now for wanting to. We don't have any money because of the Ukraine war. Well, are we going to have any democratic oversight of whether this is what we want to do in Ukraine? No, this is also forbidden. There's a sort of way in which the political decisions are acknowledged to be disastrous for populations in the very act of making them, but there's just a sort of refusal of democracy, and they're right to act like they can refuse democracy because they can refuse democracy because they've successfully put the lid on those populisms of the right and left of the previous decade. And I think there's no greater example of this than the Bidenomics experiment, which was Joe Biden coming in saying, I've always been a union man. I'm the guy who remembers, you know, I'm so old, I remember before neoliberalism. And I've learned my lesson from Trump and the Steve Bannon rhetoric about we need a productive capitalism, we need an economic nationalism. I've learned the lesson from Bernie. We need better wages and unions, and I'm going to do all that. And then just not do it. Actually give a diagnosis of the problem, acknowledge that your enemies and rivals were right in the complaints that they made, and then simply not do it. I mean, does impunity describe the kinds of processes that you analyze in this book?
Impunity to a certain extent, but also in inability to move forward, an interregnum. You can talk about it, but you can't do the necessary. That's the most striking thing about the age. I think this is difficult to explain and discuss without going back to hegemony and the nature of, in a sense, global power and imperialism, the kind of war that you spoke about before. War was not an appropriate metaphor for COVID, but war is very, very much around us now. And definitely this is a period of wars. And much of what you described is impunity and the inability of Biden to do things, or rather doing things in halves, has to do with the broader pressures on the United States and its position in the global system. You see, we've been discussing it pretty much for the core so far, but a lot more has been happening during the period of the interregnum and before, to be honest. It's become very clear in the interregnum, you see. And that has to do with the nature of core and periphery and who dominates the world system and the world market. And here, things are difficult. I'm an old-fashioned Marxist when it comes to that. Old-fashioned in the sense that, no, I don't abide by what Lenin said 100 years ago, but I try and think things through in materialistic ways when it comes to that. And the way we see it and we analyze it is pretty much like this. You start with the immediate observation. And what you see is obviously that the hegemonic position of the United States is under pressure. There are challenges, definitely. I mean, that's, your naked eyeball will tell you that. The United States cannot do what it did 30 years ago or 35 or 25 years ago. Who would have gone against the United States 25 years ago and risked it? Now they can. So there are challenges. Okay. The second question you got to ask is, where are these challenges coming from? Historically, we're used to thinking of what might be called imperialistic or hegemonic contests as occurring between advanced imperialist countries, the core of the system. Historically, not now. There isn't a single challenger to the United States who is coming out of the old states, of the old imperial states. All of them are actually doing as they're told. They're poodles. And that has been demonstrated very, very clearly the last few years. It's incredible. The worst of them all is Germany. Yeah. The so-called hegemon of Europe. Well, Europe has the hegemon it merits. So that's a very important fact to start with. The challenges, such as they are, all come from what might be called and considered the periphery, without exception. China, Russia, and then possibly Brazil, India.
For God's sake, Yemen, right?
Yeah. Who you put in depends. How I would think of that? What is it? Do the old models apply? No, they don't. And they don't apply in a variety of ways. But how? Now, if Marxism has anything to tell us about that, anything to tell us about imperialism that sets it apart from other traditions, it's not this moral critique of imperialism. It's not this moral condemnation of war. I mean, there are any number of other opinions and currents that do that. Currently, even the churches are against, you know, the horrible wars and everything else. That's not what makes Marxism different when it analyzes and criticizes imperialism. Who is in favor of imperialism except for some idiots who are paid scribes? The difference that Marxism has, the differential specifica that Marxism has about this, is that it connects imperialism to the economic structures of capitalism. Not in the crude sense of imperialist interventions are a matter of cost and benefit, right? There's some kind of capitalist somewhere with a balance sheet and adds up the merits of intervening in India against the demerits of intervening in India. And if the balance is positive, they intervene. That's not how it works. When I say economic foundations, I mean the type of capital that dominates the core economies and therefore allows them to spread their tentacles across the globe. That's what we mean by economic foundations of imperialism. Now, that is a very powerful way of looking at it, and that's what we try to do. When you think about it in those terms, you see that contemporary imperialism and contemporary core and periphery are not in the same mold as in the classical formulations, not at all. For a start, the periphery today is not non-capitalist or pre-capitalist. You see, the old models would tell you there's a capitalist core, which is powerful, advanced, economically strong, and there is a non-capitalist, pre-capitalist, whatever, feudal, whatever it is, periphery, and the capitalist core penetrates the non-capitalist periphery, and because it's so advanced and technologically powerful and militarily powerful, dictates terms and exploits it. That might have been the case 100 years ago. It doesn't exist today. The periphery is dominated by capitalist relations today. It's capitalistic. There is a global capitalist world economy. It contains a core and a periphery, but on a capitalistic basis. And that's what's striking. That needs to be analyzed, right? That's what's behind contemporary fights for hegemony. Okay, that's one point. Second point is this, which is also very important. In the classical formulations of imperialism by Marxists, which sought the economic foundations, the basic argument was put across by Rudolf Hilferding 100 years ago and adopted by Lenin, basically, in his classic formulations. And he basically said this: there are big banks, monopolistic banks, and big productive businesses, multinationals or whatever, and they come together and they create finance capital, which is basically a union of these capitals, an amalgam of these capitals dominated by the banks. This is very expansionist. It contests other finance capitals and divides the world. And therefore you get imperialism, mobilizes the state behind it, and you get imperialism and you end up with war. That's a very important insight, except that you don't get the same formulation in the core countries. There is no finance capital today. Banks do not control big business. There is no bank that controls Amazon. There is no bank that controls Microsoft. There is no bank that can tell Elon Musk what he's got to do. Such a bank doesn't exist. What you get are two types of capital that basically coexist. They have a symbiotic relationship. They live together and off each other. You get globalized productive capital, huge businesses that create global value chains, global production chains. They take advantage of cheaper labor, favorable production conditions across the world, and create these value chains across the world. They produce across borders. In other words, globalized productive capital, the most complex form of capital, not globalized trade or globalized finance, globalized production. That really is an advance of capitalism. You get then this type of capital, which has spread its tentacles across the world, and he has done so often without property rights. That's what's the most amazing thing. Because we've known globalized productive capital that goes across borders and establishes subsidiaries, which it then owns outright. But today you don't have to do that. You go across borders, you sign a contract with a producer in their own country, you create a global value chain, you dominate it by controlling technology, prices, access to finance, and so on. And the producer in Turkey, in India, in wherever, belongs to this global value chain without ever moving away from their country. You create this internationalization of productive capital in unprecedented ways, dominated by big business from key core countries, but not only. That's one type of capital. The other type of capital is globalized financial capital, financialization. Huge banks and huge investment funds which basically spread their tentacles across the world and dominate the flows of loanable capital, basically, and credit across the world. The two coexist, support each other. What they are the pair of capitals that dictate terms to the world economy. They are the most aggressive form of capital of capitals we've ever known. They consider the world economy to be their basically their area. What they need is rules for investment, rules for profit shifting, rules for employing labor, rules for transacting. They need these rules, they need this framework, and they need world money. They need a form of money which would be reliable for payments and for keeping your value, for keeping wealth, for reserving your wealth. Whoever provides the rules and provides world money is the hegemon. The hegemonic power, the hegemonic imperial power today is that power that can dictate these terms and allow these forms of capital to move in the world market. That's what the contest is about. Chinese big businesses are behaving in a similar way when they become international. Russian big businesses behaved in a similar way until sanctions were imposed on them, and they still try and do it. There is no fundamental difference in this regard among the big contestants for hegemony. What is different is that the powers that have emerged and can contest the hegemonic position of the United States come all from the periphery. And they want to say, they don't want to create a different world. People get confused. It's not as if China wants to create a nice, more equitable world. Who wants, I mean, have you thought about, can you imagine a world in which the conditions of living will be dictated by the Chinese elites? I wouldn't want to be there, right? But what is happening is the Chinese elite wants a say in how world money will be formed, in how trade will be undertaken, investment will be undertaken. And that's what the contest is about. They want a capitalism in which they have a say. That's what they contest. That's the most dangerous form of contestation. It's reminiscent of 1914. Its origins are economic. They're not ideological. It's not politics. We're used to a world, you see, in which hegemonic contestation was about politics, ideology, and so on, the Soviet Union, and so on, not economic. That's a far more stable world, because if the causes of hegemonic contests are ideological and political, you find the modus vivendi, you see. But if the causes are economic, there is no modus vivendi. Your death is my life. That's basically what's happening, and that's where we are. That's why the world is so dangerous today. So dangerous.
Well, this is a magnificent analysis that listeners are going to want to rewind and take in again. But at its heart, I think that you've shown quite what is so dangerous about today's situation, but also the fact that if you're going to understand it, you do have to be a doctrinaire Marxist about it. But additionally, there can be no good, honest class reductionism that is not also an analysis of imperialism and foreign policy. The two are absolutely gelled together. Look, I think we're going to be referring to and reading and studying The State of Capitalism, Economy, Society, and Hegemony for the next decade. It's an essential guide to taking us into this frankly terrifying world that we're entering. But for making some time for us just ahead of Christmas, I can't thank you enough, Kostas Lapavitsas.
I thank you, James. I enjoyed our discussion. I know it went on for some time. Your questions were probing and difficult. I couldn't answer without a degree of prolixity. I'm sorry.
I appreciate it.
I hope that there's some interest in this for our listeners. You're doing an excellent job anyway. Long may it be so in the future. And I enjoyed our discussion, as I said. And all I can say is that on our way to Christmas, I hope we'll get a little bit of rest and a little bit of time to think and take our minds off the appalling situation that surrounds us at the moment. Thank you.
Hope so too. God bless, and thanks again.